Ignoring the turmoil, Nynaeve gathered her skirts in bloodied hands and hurried to Rand.
"Oh, Rand," she said when she saw his arm. "I'm so sorry. I'll do what I can, but I can't fix it the way it was."
Her eyes were filled with anguish. Wordlessly, he held out his left arm. It throbbed with agony. Strangely, he could still feel his hand. It seemed he should be able to make a fist with the fingers that were no longer there. His goosebumps intensified as she drew more deeply on Sidar. The tendrils of smoke vanished from his cuff, and she gripped his arm above the wrist. His entire arm began tingling, and the pain drained away. Slowly, blackened skin was replaced by smooth skin that seemed to ooze down until it covered the small lump that had been the base of his hand. It was a miraculous thing to see. The scarlet and gold scaled dragon grew back too, as much as it could, ending in a bit of the golden mane. He could still feel the whole hand.
"I'm so sorry," Nynaeve said again. "Let me delve you for any other injuries,"
she asked, but did not wait, of course. She reached up to cup his head between her hands, and a chill ran through him.
"There's something wrong with your eyes," she said with a frown. "I'm afraid to try fixing that without studying on it. The smallest mistake could blind you. How well can you see? How many fingers am I holding up?"
"Two. I can see fine," he lied. The black flecks were gone, but everything still seemed seen through water, and he wanted to squint against a sun that appeared to glare 10 times brighter than it had. The old wounds in his side were knotted with pain. Bashir climbed down from his compact bay in front of him and frowned at the stump of his left arm. Unbuckling his helmet, he took it off and held it under his arm.
"At least you're alive," he said gruffly. "I've seen men hurt worse."
"Me too," Rand said. "I'll have to learn the sword all over again, though." Bashir nodded. Most forms required 2 hands. Rand bent to pick up the crown of Ilion, but Min released his arm and hurriedly handed the crown to him. He settled it on his head.
"I'll have to work out new ways to do everything."
"You must be in shock," Nynaeve said slowly. "You've just suffered a grievous injury, Rand. Maybe you'd better lie down. Lord Davram, have one of your men bring a saddle to put his feet up."
"He's not in shock," Min said sadly.
The bond was full of sadness. She had taken hold of his arm as if to hold him up again.
"He lost a hand, but there's nothing to do about it, so he's left it behind already."
"Wool-headed fool," Nynaeve muttered. Her hand, still smeared with Sandomir's blood, drifted toward the thick braid, hanging over her shoulder, but she yanked it back down.
"You've been hurt badly. It's all right to grieve. It's all right to feel stunned. It's normal."
"I don't have time," he told her.
Min's sadness threatened to overflow the bond. Light, he was all right. Why did she feel so sad? Nynaeve muttered half under her breath about woolhead and fool and man stubborn, but she was not finished.
"Those old wounds in your side have broken open," she almost growled. "You aren't bleeding badly, but you are bleeding. Maybe I can finally do something about them."
But as hard as she tried, and she tried 3 times, nothing changed. He still felt the slow trickle of blood sliding down his ribs. The wounds were still a throbbing knot of pain. Finally, he pushed her hand gently away from his side.
"You've done what you can, Nynaeve. It's enough."
"Fool,"
she did growl this time.
"How can it be enough when you're still bleeding?"
"Who is the tall woman?" Bashir asked. He understood, at least. You did not waste time on what could not be mended. "They didn't try passing her off as the daughter of the 9 moons, did they? Not after telling me she was a little thing."
"They did," Rand replied, and explained briefly.
"Semirag," Bashir muttered incredulously. "How can you be sure?"
"She's Aneth Dorja, not what you called her,"
a honey-skinned Suldam said loudly in a twangy drawl. Her dark eyes were tilted, and her hair was streaked with gray. She looked the eldest of the Suldam and the least frightened. It was not that she did not look afraid, but she controlled it well.
"She's the High Lady's truth-speaker."
"Be silent, Philandra,"
Semirog said coldly, looking over her shoulder. Her gaze promised pain. The Lady of Pain was good at delivering on her promises. Prisoners had killed themselves on learning it was she who held them, men and women who managed to open a vein with teeth or fingernails. Philandra did not seem to see it, though.
"You can't command me," she said scornfully. "You're not even Sojin."
"How can you be sure?"
Cadswain demanded. Those golden moons and stars, birds and fishes, swung as she moved her piercing gaze from Rand to Semirog and back. Semirog saved him the effort of thinking up a lie.
"He's insane," she said coolly.
Standing there stiff as a statue, Min's knife hilt still sticking out beside her collarbone, on the front of her black dress glistening with blood, she might have been a queen on her throne.
"Grendel could explain it better than I. Madness was her specialty. I will try, however. You know of people who hear voices in their heads? Sometimes, very rarely, the voices they hear are the voices of past lives. Lanfear claimed he knew things from our own age, things only Luzhtheran Telamon could know. Clearly, he is hearing Luzhtheran's voice. It makes no difference that his voice is real, however. In fact, that makes his situation worse. Even Grendel usually failed to achieve reintegration with someone who heard a real voice. I understand the descent into terminal madness can be abrupt."
Her lips curved in a smile that never touched her dark eyes. Were they looking at him differently? Loghain's face was a carved mask, unreadable. Bashir looked as though he could still not believe. Nynaeve's mouth hung open, and her eyes were wide. The bond, for a long moment, the bond was full of numbness. If Min turned away from him, he did not know whether he could stand it. If she turned away, it would be the best thing in the world for her. But compassion and determination as strong as mountains replaced numbness, and love so bright he thought he could have warmed his hands over it. Her grip on his arm tightened, and he tried to put a hand over hers. Too late, he remembered, and snatched the nub of his hand away, but not before it had touched her. Nothing in the bond wavered by a hair. Cadswain moved closer to the taller woman and looked up at her. Facing one of the Forsaken seemed to faze her no more than facing the Dragon Reborn did.
"You're very calm for a prisoner. Rather than deny the charge, you give evidence against yourself."
Semirog shifted that cold smile from Rand to Cadswain.
"Why should I deny myself?"
Pride dripped from every word.
"I am Semirog."
Someone gasped, and a number of the Suldam and Damani started trembling and weeping. One Suldam, a pretty yellow-haired woman, suddenly vomited down the front of herself, and another, stocky and dark, looked as if she might. Cadswain simply nodded.
"I am Cadswain Maladrin. I look forward to long talks with you."
Semirog sneered. She had never lacked courage.
"We thought she was the High Lady," Philandra said hurriedly,
and haltingly at the same time. Her teeth seemed near to chattering, but she forced her words out.
"We thought we were being honored. She took us to a room in the Terrasen Palace where there was a hole in the air. We stepped through to this place. I swear it on my eyes. We thought she was the High Lady."
"So, no army rushing toward us," Loghain said.
You could not have told from his tone whether he was relieved or disappointed. He eased an inch of his sword and thrust it back into its scabbard hard.
"What do we do with them?"
He jerked his head toward the Suldam and Damani.
"Send them to Camlann like the others?"
"We send them back to Abu Dhar," Rand said.
Cadswain turned to stare at him. Her face was a perfect mask of Aes Sedai serenity, yet he doubted she was anywhere near serene inside. The leashing of Damani was an abomination that Aes Sedai took personally. Nynaeve was anything but serene. Angry-eyed, gripping her braid in a tight, blood-daubed fist, she opened her mouth, but he spoke over her.
"I need this truce, Nynaeve, and taking these women prisoner is no way to get one.
Don't argue," That's what they'd call it, including the Damani, and you know it as well as I do. They can carry word that I want to meet the Daughter of the Nine Moons. The heir to the throne is the only one who can make a true stand.
I still don't like it, she said firmly.
We could free the Damani. The others will do as well for carrying messages.
The Damani, who had not been weeping before, burst into tears. Some of them cried to the Suldam to save them. Nynaeve's face took on a sickly cast, but she threw up her hands and gave over arguing.
The two soldiers Bashir had sent into the house came out, young men who walked with a rolling motion, more accustomed to saddles than their own feet. Ahmad had a luxuriant black beard that fell below the edge of his helmet and a scar down his face. Agan wore thick mustaches like Bashir's and carried a plain wooden box with no lid under his arm. They bowed to Bashir, free hands swinging their swords clear.
"The house is empty, my lord," Agan said. "But there's dried blood staining the carpets in several rooms. Looks like a slaughter yard, my lord. I think whoever lived here is dead. This was sitting by the front door. It didn't look like it belonged, so I brought it along."
He held out the box for inspection. Within lay coiled Adam and a number of circlets made of segmented black metal, some large, some small. Rand started to reach in with his left hand before he remembered. Min caught the movement and released his right arm so he could scoop up a handful of the black metal pieces. Nynaeve gasped.
"You know what these are?" he asked.
"They're Adam for men," she said angrily. "Aginan said she was going to drop the thing in the ocean. We trusted her, and she gave it to somebody to copy."
Rand dropped the things back into the box. There were six of the large circlets and five of the silvery leashes. Semirag had been prepared no matter who he brought with him.
"She really thought she could capture all of us."
That thought should have made him shiver. He seemed to feel Luz Theron shiver. No one wanted to fall into Semirag's hands.
"She shouted for them to shield us," Nynaeve said, "but they couldn't because we were all holding the power already. If we hadn't been, if Cad Swin and I hadn't had our Tirhungriel, I don't know what would have happened."
She did shiver. He looked at the tall Forsaken, and she stared back, utterly composed, utterly cold. Her reputation as a torturer loomed so large that it was easy to forget how dangerous she was otherwise.
"Tie off the shields on the others so they'll unravel in a few hours, and send them to somewhere near Ebu Dar."
For a moment he thought Nynaeve was going to protest again, but she contented herself with giving her braid a strong tug and turning away.
"Who are you to ask for a meeting with the High Lady?" Philandra demanded.
She emphasized the title for some reason.
"My name is Randall Thor. I'm the Dragon Reborn."
If they had wept at hearing Semirag's name, they wailed at hearing his.
Ashandarai slanted across his saddle, Matt sat pips in the darkness among the trees and waited, surrounded by 2,000 mounted crossbowmen. The sun was not long down, and events should be in motion. The Seanchan were going to be hit hard tonight in half a dozen places, some small and some not so small, but hard in every case. Moonlight filtering through the branches overhead gave just enough illumination for him to make out Tuon's shadowed face. She had insisted on staying with him, which meant Seleucia was at her side, on her dun, of course, glaring at him as usual. There was not enough moon shadows to obscure that, unfortunately. Tuon must be unhappy about what was to happen tonight, yet nothing showed on her face. What was she thinking? Her expression was all the stern magistrate.
"Your scheme do entail a good deal of luck," Teslin said, not for the first time.
Even shadowed, her face looked hard. She shifted in her saddle, adjusting her cloak.
"It'd be too late to change everything, but this part can be abandoned, certainly."
He would have preferred to have Bethamin or Sita, neither bound by the three oaths and both knowing the weaves Damani used for weapons, something that horrified the Aes Sedai. Not the weaves, just that Bethamin and Sita knew them. At least he thought he would. Lyalwyn had flatly refused to fight any Seanchan except to defend herself. Bethamin and Sita might have done the same or found at the last minute that they could not act against their countrymen.
In any case, the Aes Sedai had rejected allowing the two women to be involved, and neither had opened her mouth once that was said. That pair was too meek around Aes Sedai to say boo to a goose.
"Grace favor you, Tessalon Sedai, but Lord Matt is lucky," Captain Mandevwin said. The stocky one-eyed man had been with the band since the first days in Kyrian, and he had earned the gray streaks in his hair, hidden now beneath his green-painted helmet, an open-faced footman's helmet, in battles against Tyr and Andor before that. "I remember times we were outnumbered, with enemies on every side, and he'd dance the band around them. Not to slip away, mind, but to beat them. Beautiful battles."
"A beautiful battle is one you don't have to fight," Matt said more sharply than he intended. He did not like battles. You could get holes poked in you in a battle. He just kept getting caught in them, that was all. Most of that dancing around had been trying to slip away, but there would be no slipping away tonight, or for many days to come.
"Our part of it is important, Tessalon."
What was keeping Aludra, Burnher? The attack at the supply camp must be underway already, just strong enough that the soldiers defending it would think they could hold until help arrived, strong enough to make them sure they needed help. The others would be full strength from the start, to overwhelm the defenders before they knew what was on them.
"I mean to bloody the Seanchan. Bloody them so hard and fast and often that they're reacting to what we're doing instead of making their own plans."
As soon as the words left his tongue, he wished he had phrased that another way. Tuon leaned close to Seleucia, and the taller woman put her scarf-covered head down to exchange whispers. It was too dark for their bloody finger talk, but he could not hear a word they were saying. He could imagine. She had promised not to betray him, and that had to cover trying to betray his plans, yet she must wish she had that promise back. He should have left her with Rhaemon, or one of the others. That would have been safer than letting her stay with him. He could have, if he had tied her up, her and Seleucia both, and probably Setala as well. That bloody woman still took Tuon's side every time. Mandevwin's bay stamped a hoof, and he patted the animal's neck with a gauntleted hand.
"You cannot deny there is battle luck when you find a weakness in your enemy's lines that you never expected. That should not be there. When you find him arrayed to defend against attack from the north, only you are coming from the south. Battle luck rides on your shoulder, my lord. I have seen it."
Matt grunted and resettled his hand on his head irritably. For every time a banner got lost and blundered into a bloody chink in the enemy's defenses, there were 10 when it just was not bloody where you expected when you bloody well needed it. That was the truth of battle luck.
"One green night flower," a man called from above. "Two. Both green."
Scrapings told him of climbing down hurriedly. Matt heaved a small sigh of relief. The Rakan was away and headed west. He had counted on that. The nearest large body of soldiers loyal to the Seanchan lay west, and even cheated by riding as far west as he dared. Just because you were sure your opponent would react in a certain way did not mean he would. Rhaemon would be overrunning the supply camp any minute, smothering the defenders with 10 times their number, and securing much-needed provisions.
"Go, Vannin," he said,
and the fat man dug his heels in, sending his dun off into the night at a canter. He could not outpace the Rakan, but so long as he brought word in time.
"Time to move, Mandevwin."
A lean fellow dropped the last distance from a lower limb, carefully cradling a looking-glass that he handed up to the Kyrianin.
"Get mounted, Londrid,"
Mandevwin said, stuffing the looking-glass into the cylindrical leather case tied to his saddle.
"Cunno, form the men by fours."
A short ride took them to a narrow, hard-packed road, winding through low hills that Matt had avoided earlier. There were few farms and fewer villages in this area, but he did not want to spread rumors of large parties of armed men. Not until he wanted them to spread, anyway. Now he needed speed, and rumor could not outrun him in tonight's business. Most of the farmhouses they trotted by were dark shapes in the moonlight, lamps and candles already extinguished. The thud of hooves and the creak of saddle leather were the only sounds aside from the occasional thin, reedy cry of some nightbird or an owl's hooting, but 2,000 or so horses made a fair amount of noise. They passed through a small village where only a handful of thatch-roofed houses and the tiny stone inn showed any light, but people stuck their heads out of doors and windows to gape. Doubtless, they thought they were seeing soldiers loyal to the Seanchan. There seemed to be few of any other kind remaining in most of Altara. Somebody raised a cheer, but he was a lone voice. Matt rode alongside Mandevwin, with Tuon and the other women behind, and now and then he looked over his shoulder, not to make sure she was still there. Strange as it was, he had no doubt she would keep her word not to escape even now, and not to make sure she was keeping up. The Razor had an easy stride, and she rode well. Pips could not have outrun Achaean had he tried. No, he just liked looking at her, even by moonlight. Maybe especially by moonlight. He had tried kissing her again the night before, and she had punched him in the side so hard that at first he thought she had broken one of his short ribs. But she had kissed him just before they started out this evening. Only once, and said not to be greedy when he attempted a second. The woman melted in his arms when he was kissing her, and turned to ice the moment she stepped back. What was he to make of her? A large owl passed overhead, wings flapping silently. Would she see some omen in that? Probably. He should not be spending so much time thinking about her, not tonight. In truth, he was depending on luck to some extent. The 3,000 lancers Vannin had found, mostly Altarans with a few Shonchan, might or might not be those Master Roydell had marked on his map, though they had not been too far from where he placed them, but there was no telling for sure in which direction they had moved since. Northeast, almost certainly, toward the Malvidi Narrows and the Mulvane Gap beyond. It seemed that except for the last stretch, the Shonchan had taken to avoiding the Lugard Road for moving soldiers, doubtless to conceal their numbers and destinations in the country roads. Certain was not absolutely sure, however. If they had not moved too far, this was the road they would use to reach that supply camp. If. But if they had ridden farther than he expected, they might use another road. No danger there, just a wasted night. Their commander might decide to cut straight across the hills, too. That could prove nasty if he decided to join this road at the wrong point. About 4 miles beyond the village, they came to a place where two gently sloping hills flanked the road, and he called a halt. Master Roydell's own maps were fine, but those he had from other men were the work of masters, too. Roydell acquired only the best. Matt recognized this spot as if he had seen it before. Mandevwin wheeled his horse around.
Admar, Eindel, take your men up the north slope. Madwin, Dongle, the south slope. 1 man in 4 to hold horses.
Hobble the horses, Matt said, and put the feed bags on to stop whinnying. They were facing lancers. If it all turned sour and they tried to run, those lancers would ride them down like they were hunting wild pigs. A crossbow was no good from horseback, especially if you were trying to get away. They had to win here. The Kyrianan stared at him, any expression hidden by the face bars of his helmet, but he did not hesitate.
Hobble the horses and put on their nose bags, he ordered. Every man on the line.
Tell off some to keep watch north and south, Matt told him. Battle luck can run against you as easily as in your favor. Mandevwin nodded and gave the order. The crossbowmen divided and rode up the thinly treed slopes, their dark coats and dull green armor fading into the shadows. Burnished armor was all very well for parades, but it could reflect moonlight as well as sunlight. According to Telmanis, the hardest part had been convincing the lancers to give up their bright breastplates and the nobles their silvering and gilding. The foot had seen sense straight off. For a time, there was the rustle of men and horses moving across the mulch, moving through brush, but finally silence fell. From the road, Matt could not have told there was anyone on either slope. Now, he just had to wait. Tuon and Seleucia kept him company, and so did Teslin, though a gusting breeze had sprung up from the west that tugged at cloaks. But of course, Aes Sedai could ignore such things, though Teslin held hers shut. Seleucia let the gusts take her cloak where it would, oddly, but Tuon took to holding hers closed with one hand. "You might be more comfortable among the trees," he told her. "They'll cut the wind." For a moment she shook with silent laughter. "I'm enjoying watching you take your ease on your hilltop," she drawled. Matt blinked. "Hilltop?" He was sitting Pips in the middle of the bloody road with flaming gusts cutting through his coat like winter was coming back. What was she talking about, hilltop?
"Have a care with Jolene," Teslin said, suddenly and unexpectedly. She be childish in some ways, and you do fascinate her, the way a shiny new toy do fascinate a child. She will bond you if she can decide how to convince you to agree. Perhaps even if you do not realize you be agreeing.
He opened his mouth to say there was no bloody flaming chance of that, but Tuan spoke first.
She cannot have him, she said sharply.
Drawing a breath, she went on, in amused tones.
Toy belongs to me, until I am through playing with him. But even then I won't give him to a Marath Damani. You understand me, Tessie? You tell Rosie that. That's the name I intend to give her. You can tell her that, too.
The sharp gusts might not have affected Teslin, but she shivered at hearing her Damani name. Aes Sedai's serenity vanished as rage contorted her face.
What I do understand.
Give over, Matt cut in, both of you. I'm in no mood to listen to the pair of you trying to jab each other with needles.
Teslin stared at him, indignation plain even by moonlight.
Why, Toy, Tuan said brightly, you're being masterful again.
She leaned over to Seleucia and whispered something that made the bosomy woman give a loud guffaw. Hunching his shoulders and pulling his cloak around him, he leaned on the high pommel of his saddle and watched the night for Vannin.
Women. He would give up all of his luck, well, half, if he could understand women.
What do you think you can achieve with raids and ambushes? Teslin said, again not for the first time. The Shonchan will only send enough soldiers to hunt you down.
She and Jolene had kept trying to stick their noses into his planning, and so had Edesina to a lesser extent, until he chased them away. Aes Sedai thought they knew everything, and while Jolene at least did know something of war, he had not needed advice. Aes Sedai advice sounded an awful lot like telling you what to do. This time, he decided to answer her.
I'm counting on them sending more soldiers, Teslin, he said, still watching for Vannin. The whole army they have in the Molvain Gap, in fact. Enough of it, anyway. They're more likely to use that than any other. Everything Tom and Julin picked up says their big push is aimed at Ilion. I think the army in the Gap is to guard against anything coming at them out of Murundi or Andor. But they're the stopper in the jar for us. I mean to pull that stopper out so we can pass through.
After several minutes of silence, he looked over his shoulder. The three women were just sitting their horses and watching him. He wished he had enough light to make out their expressions. Why were they bloody staring? He settled back to looking for Vannin, yet it seemed he could feel their eyes on his back.
Perhaps 2 hours by the shifting of the fat crescent moon went by, with the wind slowly picking up strength. It was enough to take the night beyond cool into cold. Periodically he tried to make the women take shelter among the trees, but they resisted stubbornly. He had to remain to catch Vannin without having to shout. The lancers would be close behind the man, perhaps very close if their commander was a fool, but they did not. He suspected that Teslin refused because Tuan and Seleucia did. That made no sense, but there it was. As for why Tuan refused, he could not have said, unless it was because she liked to listen to him arguing himself hoarse. Eventually, the wind brought the sound of a running horse, and he sat up straight in his saddle. Vannin's dun cantered out of the night, the bulky man as always, an improbable sight in a saddle. Vannin drew rein and spat through a gap in his teeth.
They're a mile or so behind me, but there's maybe 1,000 more than there was this morning. Who's ever in charge knows his business. They're pushing hard without blowing their horses.
If you be outnumbered 2-1, Teslin said, perhaps you will reconsider.
I don't intend to give them a stand-up fight, Matt broke in, and I can't afford to leave 4,000 lancers loose to make trouble for me. Let's join Mandevwin.
The kneeling crossbowman on the slope of the northern hill made no sound when he rode through their line with the women and Vannin, just shuffled aside to let them through. He would have preferred at least 2 ranks, but he needed to cover a wide front. The sparse trees did cut the wind, but not by much, and most of the men were huddled in their cloaks. Still, every crossbow he could see was drawn, with a bolt in place. Mandevwin had seen Vannin arrive, and knew what it meant. The Kyrianin was pacing just behind the line until Matt appeared and swung down from Pips. Mandevwin was relieved to hear that he no longer needed to keep a watch to his rear. He merely nodded thoughtfully at hearing of 1,000 more lancers than expected, and sent a man racing off to bring the watchers down from the crest to take their places in the line. If Matt Cawthon took it in stride, so would he. Matt had forgotten that about the band. They trusted him absolutely. Once, that had almost made him break out in a rash. Tonight he was glad of it. An owl hooted twice, somewhere behind him, and Tuon sighed. "Is there an omen in that?" he asked, just for something to say.
"I'm glad you are finally taking an interest, Toy. Perhaps I will be able to educate you yet."
Her eyes were liquid in the moonlight. "An owl hooting twice means someone will die soon." Well, that put a bloody end to conversation. Soon enough, the Seanchan appeared, 4 abreast, and leading their horses at a trot, lances in hand. Vannin had been right about their commander knowing his job. Cantered for a time, then led at a trot, horses could cover a lot of ground quickly. Fools tried to gallop long distances and ended with dead or crippled horses. Only the first 40 or so wore the segmented armor and strange helmets of Seanchan. A pity, that. He had no idea how the Seanchan would feel about casualties to their Altaran allies. Losses to their own would catch notice, though. When the middle of the column was right in front of him, a deep voice on the road suddenly shouted, "Banner, hold!" Those 2 words carried the familiar slurred drawl of the Seanchan. The men in segmented armor stopped sharply. The others straggled to a halt. Matt drew breath. Now that had to be Taviran work. They could hardly have been better placed if he had given the order himself. He rested a hand on Teslin's shoulder. She flinched slightly, but he needed to get her attention quietly.
"Banner!" the deep voice shouted. "Mount!"
Below, soldiers moved to obey.
"Now," Matt said quietly.
The fox head went cold on his chest, and suddenly a red ball of light was floating high above the road, bathing the soldiers below in an unearthly glow. They had only a heartbeat to gape. Along the line below Matt, 1,000 crossbow strings gave what sounded like 1 loud snap, and 1,000 bolts streaked into the formation, punching through breastplates at that short range, knocking men from their feet, sending horses rearing and screaming, just as 1,000 more struck from the other side. Not every shot struck squarely, but that hardly mattered with a heavy crossbow. Men went down with shattered legs, with legs ripped half off. Men clutched at the stumps of ruined arms, trying to stem the flow of blood. Men screamed as loudly as the horses. He watched a crossbowman nearby as the fellow bent to fasten the paired hooks of the bulky box-like crank hanging from a strap at the front of his belt to his crossbow string. As the man straightened, the cord streamed out of the crank, but once he was erect, he set the crank on the butt of the upended crossbow, moved a small lever on the side of the box, and began to work the handles. 3 quick turns with a rough whirring sound, and the string caught on the latch.
"Into the trees!" the deep voice shouted. "Close with them before they can reload! Move!"
Some tried to mount, to ride into the attack, and others dropped reins and lances to draw swords. None made it as far as the trees. 2,000 more bolts slashed into them, cutting men down, punching through men to kill men behind or topple horses. On the hillside, men began working their cranks furiously, but there was no need. On the road, a horse kicked feebly here and there. The only men moving were frantically trying to use whatever they had to hand for tourniquets to keep from bleeding to death. The wind brought the sound of running horses. Some might have riders. There were no more shouts from the deep voice.
"Mandevwin," Matt shouted. "We're done here. Mount the men. We have places to be."
"You must stay to offer aid," Teslin said firmly. "The rules of war do demand it."
"This is a new kind of war," he told her harshly.
Light was silent on the road, but he could still hear the screaming.
"They'll have to wait for their own to give them aid."
Tuon murmured something half under her breath. He thought it was, "A lion can have no mercy," but that was ridiculous. Gathering his men, he led them down the north side of the hill. There was no need to let the survivors see how many they were. In a few hours, they would join up with the men from the other hill, and in a few hours more, with Carloman. Before sunrise, they were going to hit the Seanchan again. He intended to make them run
to pull that bloody stopper for him.
Chapter 28. In Malden. Just before first light, Fail was fastening the wide belt of golden links around her waist for the last time when Dairain entered the small, already crowded, peaked tent where they all slept. Outside, the sky would be starting to turn gray, but inside it might still have been night. Fail's eyes had adapted to the darkness, though. The slender little woman with black hair that spilled to her waist in waves was frowning around her yawns. She had stood just below the high seat of her house in Kyrian, but she had been wakened in the night because Savannah could not sleep and wanted to be read to. Savannah enjoyed Dairain's voice, and likely the tales she carried of supposed misdeeds among Savannah's Guy Shine. The Kyrianan woman was never chosen out as one of those who had failed to please. Her hands went to her golden collar, then hesitated when she took in Fail, Aleandra, and Megdin, already dressed and on their feet. "I forgot to put the book back in the proper place," she said in a voice like crystal chimes, turning back toward the tent flap. "Savannah will have me beaten if she sees it out of place when she wakes."
"She's lying," Megdin growled, and Dairain darted for outside.
That was enough to convince Fail. She grabbed the woman's cowl and hauled her back into the tent. Dairain opened her mouth to scream, but Aleandra clapped her hand over it, and the three of them wrestled the woman to the blanket-strewn groundcloth. It took all three. Dairain was small, but she writhed like a snake, tried to claw at them, to bite. While the other two held the woman down, Fail produced the second knife she had secured, a quite serviceable dagger with a ridged steel hilt and a blade longer than her hand, and began slicing strips from one of the blankets.
"How did you know?" Aleandra said, struggling to contain one of Dairain's arms while keeping her mouth covered without being bitten.
Megdin had taken care of the woman's legs by sitting on them and had her other arm twisted to her shoulder blades. Dairain still managed to twist, if uselessly. She was frowning, but when she spoke, her face went smooth. I could just make it out. If she were really worried about being beaten, she'd have frowned harder, not stopped. The golden-haired woman was not a very skilled lady's maid, yet she was a very observant one.
But what made her suspicious?
Megdin shrugged.
Maybe one of us looked surprised or guilty, though I can't say how she could have noticed without any light.
Soon enough they had Dairain trussed up with her ankles and wrists tied together behind her back. She would not wriggle far like that. A wadded length torn from her shift and tied in place with another piece of blanket served for a gag that let her emit only grunts. She twisted her head to glare up at them. Fail could not see her face very well, but the woman's expression had to be either glaring or pleading, and Dairain only pleaded with Shido. She used her position as one of Savannah's Guy Shine to bully Guy Shine who were not, and her tail-carrying to bully those who were. The trouble was they could not leave her here. Someone might come at any moment to summon one of them to serve Savannah.
"We can kill her and hide the body," Aleandra suggested, smoothing her long hair that had become disarrayed in the struggle.
"Where?" Megdin said, combing her own sun-gold hair with her fingers. She did not sound a lady's maid speaking to a queen. Prisoners were equals in their captivity, or else they aided their captors. It had taken time to teach Aleandra that.
"It has to be somewhere she won't be found for at least a day. Savannah might send men after Galena to bring us back if we're suspected of killing one of her belongings."
She vested that word with all the scorn it would bear.
"And I don't trust Galena not to let them bring us back."
Dairain began struggling against her bonds again and grunting harder than ever. Maybe she had decided to plead after all.
"We aren't going to kill her," Fail told them. She was being neither squeamish nor merciful. There simply was nowhere they could be sure a body would remain hidden long enough, not that they could reach without being seen.
"I'm afraid our plans have changed a little. Wait here." Ducking outside, where the sky was indeed beginning to pearl, she found what had made Dairain suspicious. Bane and Chiad were there in their plain white robes, as expected, to escort them as far as the meeting place.
Rolan and his friends might not be done breakfasting yet. She hoped they were not. They might do something foolish and ruin everything. And Bane and Chiad had volunteered to divert any men who tried to interfere with them. She had not been able to make herself ask how they intended to do that. Some sacrifices deserved a veil of secrecy, and all of a heart's gratitude. Two Gaishine holding wicker baskets were not enough to rouse suspicion in the Kyrianan woman, but 30 or 40 Gaishine were crowding the narrow muddy lane through the Gaishine tents. Aravine's plump, plain face watched her from a white cowl, and Lusara's beautiful one. Alvon was there with his son Theril in their robes of muddy tent cloth, and Alinia, a plump Amadisian silversmith in dirty, coarse white linen, and Dorman, a stocky Kyrianan bootmaker, and Corvilla, a lean weaver from right here in Altara, and... They represented not a tenth part of those who had sworn to her, but a gathering of Gaishine this large would have planted suspicion in a stone, at least when added to the three of them being dressed. Dairane likely had heard who had been summoned to Savannah this morning. How had they learned she was leaving today? It was too late to worry about that. If any Shido knew, they would all have been dragged from the tent before this. "What are you doing here?" she demanded.
"We wanted to see you go, my lady,"
Theril said in his rough, barely intelligible accents. "We were very careful to come by ones and twos." Lusara nodded happily, and she was not the only one. "Well, we can say goodbye now," Fael said firmly. No need to tell them how close they had come to ruining the escape. "Until I come back for you." If her father would not give her an army, then Perrin would. His friendship with Randall Thor would provide it. Light, where was he? No. She had to be glad he had not caught up yet, had not gotten himself killed trying to sneak into the camp and rescue her. She had to be glad and not think of what might be delaying him. "Now go, before someone sees you here and runs to tell tales. And don't talk to anyone about this." Her adherents were safe enough, otherwise she would already be chained. But there were too many like Dairane among the Gaishine, and not only among the long-held Kyrianan. Some people naturally set to licking wrists wherever they were. They bowed or curtsied or knuckled their foreheads just as if nobody might be poking their heads out to see, and scattered in every direction with chagrined expressions. They really had expected to watch her leave. She had no time to fritter away on exasperation. Hurrying to Bane and Chiad, she hastily explained the situation inside the tent. They exchanged glances when she finished and put down the baskets to free fingers for maiden hand talk. She avoided looking at their hands, since they plainly wanted privacy. Not that she could have understood much in any case. Their hands moved very fast. Flame-haired Bane, with her dark blue eyes, stood nearly half a hand taller than she, gray-eyed Chiad just a finger taller. They were her close friends, but they had adopted each other as first sisters, and that created bonds closer than any friendship. "We will take care of Dairane, Saigon," Chiad said at last. "But it means you must go into the town alone." Fael sighed, but there was no helping it. Perhaps Rolan was already awake. He could be watching her that minute. He always seemed to appear out of nowhere when she needed him. Surely he would not interfere with her leaving, not when he had promised to take her when he himself left. Yet he still had hopes, so long as she wore white. Him and his kissing games. He might want to keep her in Gaishine robes a little longer. When men wanted to help, they always thought their way was the only way. Bane and Chiad ducked into the small peaked tent, and Alejandra and Megden came out. There really was not room inside for five. Megden went around the side of the tent and returned with a basket like those the other women had been carrying. Dirty Gaishine robes bulged out of the top of each, making them appear loads of laundry, but beneath were dresses that came near enough fitting, a hatchet, a sling, cords for making snares, flint and steel, packets of flour, meal, dried beans, salt and yeast, a few coins they had been able to find, everything they would need to make their way west, to find Perrin. Galena would take them out of the camp, but there was no saying which direction her Aes Sedai business would take her then. They had to be self-reliant from the start. Fael would not put it past the Aes Sedai to abandon them as soon as she was able. Megden stood over her basket with an air of determination, her jaw set and her eyes firm, but Alejandra's face was wreathed in smiles. "Try not to look so happy," Fail told her. Wetlander Geishine seldom smiled, and never so joyfully. Alejandra tried to moderate her expression, but every time she smoothed her smiles away, they crept back. "We're escaping today," she said. "It's hard not to smile." "You'll stop if some wise one sees you and decides to find out why you're happy." "We're hardly likely to meet a wise one among the Geishine tents or in Malden," the woman said through a smile. Determined or not, Megden nodded agreement. Fail gave up. In truth, she felt a little giddy herself in spite of Dairain. They were escaping today. Bane came out of the tent, holding the tent flap for Chiad, who was carrying on her back a blanket-wrapped bundle just large enough to be a small woman doubled up. Chiad was strong, but she had to lean forward a little to support the weight. "Why is she so still?" Fail asked. She had no fear they had killed Dairain. They were fierce about following the rules for Geishine, and violence was forbidden. But that blanket could have been full of wood for all that it moved. Bane spoke softly, an amused light in her eyes. "I stroked her hair and told her I would be very upset if I had to hurt her. Simple truth, considering how much even slapping her would cost me." Chiad chuckled. "I think Dairain Saigon thought we were threatening her. I think she will be very quiet and very still until we let her go." She shook with silent laughter. Aiel's humor was still a mystery to Fael. She knew they would be punished severely for this, though. Aiding an escape attempt was dealt with as harshly as trying to escape. "You have all my gratitude," she said. "You and Chiad both, now and forever. I have great toe." She kissed Bane lightly on the cheek, which made the woman blush as red as her hair, of course. Aiel were almost prudishly restrained in public, in some ways. Bane glanced at Chiad, and a faint smile appeared on her lips. "When you see Gaul, tell him Chiad is Geishine to a man with strong hands, a man whose heart is fire. He will understand. I need to help her carry our burden to a safe place. May you always find water and shade, Fail Bashir." She touched Fail's cheek lightly with her fingertips. "One day we will meet again." Going over to Chiad, she took one end of the blanket, and they hurried away, carrying it between them. Gaul might understand, but Fail did not. Not the heart of fire, anyway, and she doubted that Mandaric's hands interested Chiad in the slightest. The man had bad breath, and started getting drunk as soon as he woke, unless he was going on a raid or hunting. But she put Gaul and Mandaric out of her mind and shouldered her basket. They had wasted too much time already. The sky was beginning to take on the appearance of actual daylight, and Geishine were stirring among the wildly diverse tents of the camp close on Malden's walls, scurrying off to be about some chore, or at least carrying something to give a semblance of working. But none paid any mind to three women in white carrying baskets of laundry toward the town's gates. There always seemed to be laundry to be done, even for Savannah's Geishine. There were far too many Wetlander Geishine for Fael to know everyone, and she saw no one she knew until they came on Arala and Lasiel, shifting from foot to foot with baskets on their shoulders. Taller than most Aiel women and dark, Arala kept her black hair cut as short as any maiden and strode like a man when she walked. Lasiel was short and pale and slim and had red ribbons tied in her hair, which was not much longer. Her walk was graceful in robes, and had been a scandalous sway when she had worn breeches. Their sighs of relief were nearly identical, though. "We thought something had happened," Arala said. "Nothing we couldn't handle," Fael told her. "Where are Bane and Chiad?" Lasiel asked anxiously. "They have another task," Fael said. "We go alone." They exchanged glances, and their sighs were far from relieved this time. Of course Rolan would not interfere. Not with them getting away. Of course not. The iron-strapped gates of Malden stood open, shoved back against the granite walls as they had since the city fell. Rust had turned the broad iron straps brown, and the hinges were so rusty that pushing the gates shut again might be impossible. Pigeons nested in the grey stone towers flanking them now. They were the first to arrive. At least, Fail could see no one ahead of them down the street. As they walked through the gates, she retrieved her dagger from the pocket inside her sleeve and held it with the blade pressed against her wrist, pointing up her arm. The other women made similar motions, if not so deftly. Without Bane and Chiad, and hoping that Rolan and his friends were otherwise occupied, they had to provide their own protection. Malden was not as dangerous for a woman, for a Gai Shine woman. Shido, who tried to prey on their own, got short shrift. Not as dangerous as the Shido portion of the camp, yet women had been assaulted there, sometimes by groups of men. The light send, if they were accosted, it was only by one or two. One or two they might catch by surprise and kill before they realized these Gai Shine had teeth. If there were more than two, they would do what they could, but an Aiel weaver or potter was as dangerous as most trained armsmen. Baskets or no baskets, they walked on their toes, heads swiveling, ready to spring in any direction. This part of the town had not been burned, yet it had a look of desolation. Broken dishes and pottery crunched beneath their soft white boots. Bits of clothing, cut off men and women made Gai Shine, still littered the grey paving stones. Those sorry, bedraggled rags had lain first in the snow and then in the rain for well over a month, and she doubted any rag picker would have gathered them now. Here and there lay children's toys, a wooden horse or a doll whose paint was beginning to flake, dropped by the very young who had been allowed to flee like the very old, the ill and infirm. Slate-roofed buildings of wood or stone along the street showed gaping holes where their doors and windows had been. Along with anything the Shido considered valuable or useful, the town had been stripped of every easily removable piece of wood, and only the fact that tearing down houses was less efficient than cutting firewood in the surrounding forests had spared the wooden structures themselves. Those openings minded Fail of eye sockets in skulls. She had walked along this street countless times, yet this morning they seemed to be watching her. They made her scalp crawl. Halfway across the town she looked back toward the gates, no more than 150 paces behind. The street was still empty for the moment, but soon the first white-clad men and women would materialize with their water buckets. Fetching water was a task that began early and lasted all day. They had to hurry now. Turning down a narrower side street, she started to walk faster, although she had trouble keeping her basket balanced. The others must have been having the same difficulty, yet no one complained. They had to be out of sight before those Gai Shine appeared. There was no reason for any Gai Shine entering the town to leave the main street until they reached the cistern below the fortress. An attempt to curry favor or just a careless word could send Shido into the town hunting for them, and there was only one way out, short of climbing onto the walls and dropping 10 paces to the ground, hoping that no one broke a leg. At a now signless inn, 3 stories of stone and empty windows, she darted into the common room, followed by the others. Lucille set down her basket and pressed herself against the doorframe to keep watch up the street. The beam-ceilinged room was bare to the dusty floorboards, and the stone fireplaces were missing their andirons and fire tools. The railing had been stripped from the staircase at the back of the room, and the door to the kitchen was gone, too. The kitchen was just as empty. She had checked. Pots and knives and spoons were useful. Fail lowered her basket to the floor and hurried to the side of the staircase. It was a sturdy piece of work, of heavy timbers, and made to last for generations. Tearing it down would have been nearly as hard as tearing down a house. She felt underneath, along the top of the wide outer support, and her hand closed on the wrist-thick, not quite glassy rod. It had seemed as good a hiding place as she could find, a place no one would have any reason to look, but she was surprised to find she had been holding her breath. Lucille remained by the doorway, but the others hurried to Fail without their baskets. "At last," Aleandra said, gingerly touching the rod with her fingertips. "The price of our freedom. What is it?" "An Angreal," Fail said. "Or perhaps a Turangreal. I don't know for certain, except that Galena wants it very badly, so it must be one or the other." Megden put her hand on the rod boldly. It could be either, she murmured. They often have an odd feel. So I've been told, anyway. She claimed never to have been to the White Tower, but Fael was not so sure she once had been. Magdin could channel, but so weakly and with so much difficulty that the wise ones saw no danger in letting her walk free. Well, as free as any Gaishine was. Her denials might well be a matter of shame. Fael had heard that women who had been put out of the tower because they could not become Aes Sedai sometimes denied ever having gone in order to hide their failure. Arila gave a shake of her head and backed away a step. She was Tyran, and, despite traveling with Aes Sedai, she was still uncomfortable over the power or anything to do with it. She looked at the smooth white rod as if at a red adder and licked her lips. Galena might be waiting on us. She might get angry if we make her wait long. Is the way still clear, Lasiel? Fael asked as she stuck the rod far down into her basket. Arila exhaled heavily, clearly as relieved at having the thing out of her sight as she had been to see Fael earlier. Yes, the Kyrianin replied. But I do not understand why. She still stood so that one eye could peek around the corner of the doorframe. The first Gaishine should be coming for water by now. Maybe something has happened in the camp, Magdin said. Suddenly her face was grim, and her knife was in her hand, a wooden-handled affair with a chipped and pitted blade. Fael nodded slowly. Maybe something such as Dairain having been found already. She could not tell where Fael and the others had been going, but she might have recognized some among the waiting Gaishine. How long would they hold out, if put to the question? How long would Alvon hold out if Theril were? There's nothing we can do about it in any case. Galena will get us out. Even so, when they left the inn, they ran, carrying the baskets in front of them and trying to hold up their long robes so they did not trip. Fael was not the only one to look over her shoulder frequently and stumble. She was not sure whether or not she was relieved to finally see Gaishine carrying buckets on ropes drift across the crossing of the town's main street. She certainly did not slow down. They did not have far to run. In moments, the smell of charred wood that had faded from the rest of Maldon began to grow. The southern end of Maldon was a ruin. They halted at the edge of the devastation and edged around a corner so they would not be seen by anyone glancing down the street. From where they stood to the southern wall, near 200 paces, marched roofless shells with blackened stone walls interspersed with piles of charred beams, washed clean of ash by the rains. In places, not even the heaviest timbers remained. Only on the south side of this street were there any structures even close to whole. This was where the fire that raged after the Shido took the city had been finally stopped. Half a dozen buildings stood without roofs, though the lower floors looked intact, and twice as many were leaning piles of black timbers and half-burned boards that appeared on the edge of collapse. There, Magdin said, pointing east along the street. A long length of red cloth fluttered in the breeze where she pointed. It was tied to a house that seemed ready to fall in. Walking to it slowly, they rested their baskets on the paving stones. The red cloth fluttered again. Why would she want to meet us here? Alejandra muttered. That could cave in if anybody sneezed. She rubbed at her nose as though the word had given her the urge. It is quite sound. I inspected it. Galena's voice behind them jerked Fael's head around. The woman was striding toward them, plainly from one of the sound buildings on the north side of the street. After so long seeing her in that belt and collar of gold and firedrops, she looked odd without them. She still wore her white silk robes, but the absence of the jewelry was convincing. Galena had not somehow managed to turn truth on its head. She was leaving today. Why not in one of the sound buildings? Fael demanded. Or right here? Because I don't want anyone to see it in my hands, Galena said, walking past her. Because no one will look inside that ruin. Because I say so. She stepped through what had been a doorway, ducking under a heavy, charred roof beam that slanted across the opening, and immediately turned to her right and began descending stairs. Don't dawdle. Fael exchanged looks with the other women. This was more than passing strange. If she'll get us out of here, Alejandra growled, snatching up her basket, I'm willing to hand her the thing in a privy. Still, she waited on Fayil to pick up her own basket and lead the way. Charred timbers and blackened boards hung low over the stone stairs that led downward, but Galena's ease at entering reassured Fayil. The woman would not risk being buried alive or crushed at the very moment she finally gained the rod. Bars and beams of light filtering through gaps in the wreckage gave enough illumination to show that the basement was quite clear, despite the treacherous nature of what lay above. Large barrels stacked along one stone wall, most scorched and with staves sprung from the heat, said that this had been an inn or a tavern, or perhaps a wine merchant's shop. The area around Malden had produced a great deal of mediocre wine. Galena stood in the middle of the grit-covered stone floor in a small beam of light. Her face was all Aes Sedai calm, her agitation of the previous day completely subdued. "Where is it?" she said coolly. "Give it to me." Fayil set her basket down and shoved her hand deep inside. When she brought out the white rod, Galena's hands twitched. Fayil extended the rod toward her, and she reached for it almost hesitantly. If she had not known better, Fayil would have said she was afraid to touch it. Galena's fingers closed around the rod, and she exhaled heavily. She jerked the rod away before Fayil could release it. The Aes Sedai seemed to be trembling, but her smile was triumphant. "How do you intend to get us away from the camp?" Fayil asked. "Should we change our clothes now?" Galena opened her mouth, then suddenly raised her free hand, palm out. Her head tilted toward the stairs as if listening. "It may be nothing," she said softly, "but it's best if I check. Wait here and be quiet. Be quiet," she hissed when Fayil started to speak. Lifting the hem of her silk robes, the Aes Sedai scurried to the stairs and started up like a woman uneasy about what she might find at the top. Her feet passed out of sight behind the sagging boards and beams. "Did any of you hear anything?" Fayil whispered. They all shook their heads. "Maybe she's holding the power. I've heard that can—" "She wasn't," Megden interrupted. "I've never seen her embracing—" Suddenly wood groaned overhead, and with a thunderous crash, charred beams and boards collapsed, sending out blinding billows of black dust and grit that sent Fayil into paroxysms of coughing. The smell of charring suddenly was as thick in the air as it had been the day Malden burned. Something falling from above hit her shoulder hard, and she crouched, trying to protect her head. Someone cried out. She heard other falling objects hit the basement's stone floor, boards or pieces of boards. Nothing made a loud enough noise to be a roof beam or a heavy joist. Eventually, it seemed like hours, it might have been minutes, the rain of debris stopped. The dust began to thin. Quickly she looked around for her companions and found them all huddling on the floor with their arms around their heads. There seemed to be more light than before, a little more. Some of the gaps overhead were wider now. A trickle of blood ran down Alejandra's face from her scalp. Everyone was dusted with black from head to foot. "Is anyone injured?" Fayil asked, finishing with a cough. The dust had not cleared completely, and her throat and tongue felt coated with it. The stuff tasted like charcoal. "No," Alejandra said, touching her scalp gingerly. "A scrape, that's all." The others denied injury as well, though Arala seemed to be moving her right arm carefully. No doubt they had all suffered bruises, and Fayil thought her left shoulder was going to be black and blue shortly, but she would not count that a real injury. Then her eyes fell on the stairs, and she wanted to weep. Wreckage from above filled the whole space where the staircase had been. They might have been able to squeeze through some of the gaps overhead. Fayil thought she could reach them, standing on Arala's shoulders, but she doubted she could pull herself through with one good arm, or that Arala could. And if either managed, she would be in the middle of a burned-out ruin and likely as not make the rest of the thing fall in, too. "No," Alejandra moaned. "Not now! Not when we were so close!" Rising, she rushed as near to the rubble as she could get, almost pressing against it, and began to shout. "Galena, help us! We're trapped! Channel and lift the boards away! Clear a path for us to get out! Galena! 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 She sagged against the tangle of timbers, shoulders shaking. Galena! She wept. Galena, help us! Galena's gone, Fael said bitterly. The woman would have answered if she was still above or had any intention of aiding them. With us trapped down here, maybe dead, she has the perfect excuse for leaving us behind. Anyway, I don't know whether an Aes Sedai could move some of those timbers if she tried. She did not want to mention the possibility that Galena had arranged that excuse herself. Light, she should never have slapped the woman. It was too late for self-recrimination, though. What are we going to do now? Arala asked. Dig ourselves out, Fael and Magdan said at the same instant. Fael looked at the other woman in surprise. Her maid's dirty face wore a queen's resolve. Yes, Aleandra said, straightening. She turned around, and if runnels of tear tracks marked the dust on her face, no new tears appeared. She really was a queen, and could not like being shamed by the courage of a lady's maid. We'll dig ourselves out, and if we fail, I will not die wearing this. Unfastening her golden belt, she flung it contemptuously into a corner of the basement. Her golden collar followed. We'll need those to make our way through the Shido camp, Fael said gently. Galena may not be taking us out, but I intend leaving today. Dairain made that imperative. Bane and Chiad could not keep her hidden long. Or as soon as we can dig out, anyway. We'll pretend we've been sent to pick berries. She did not want to step on her liege woman's bold gesture, though. However, we don't need to wear them now. Removing her belt and collar, she righted her basket and set them atop the dirty Gaishine robes. The others emulated her. Aleandra retrieved her own belt and collar with a rueful laugh. At least she could laugh again. Fael wished she could. The jumble of charred timbers and half-burned boards filling the staircase resembled one of those blacksmith's puzzles her Perrin enjoyed. Almost everything seemed to be propping up something else. Worse, the heavier timbers might be beyond all of them working together. But if they could clear enough for them to be able to crawl through, writhing between the thick beams, it would be dangerous, that crawl. But when a dangerous path was your only route to safety, you had to take it. A few boards came away easily and were piled at the back of the basement, but after that everything had to be chosen with care, examined to see whether anything would fall if it were removed, hands feeling back as far as they could go into the tangle, groping for nails that might have caught, trying not to think about the whole pile shifting and trapping an arm, crushing it. Only then could they begin pulling, sometimes two of them together, tugging harder and harder until the piece suddenly gave. That work went slowly, with the great pile occasionally groaning or shifting slightly. Everyone darted back, holding their breath when that happened. Nobody moved again until they were sure the snarl of timbers was not going to collapse. The work became the focus of their world. Once Fael thought she heard wolves howling. Wolves generally made her think of Perrin, but not this time. The work was all. Then Aleandra wrenched a charred board free, and with a great groan the mass began to shift toward them. Everyone ran toward the back of the basement as the pile fell in with a deafening rumble, sending up more billows of dust. When they stopped coughing and could see again, dimly, with dust still hanging in the air, perhaps a quarter of the basement was filled. All of their work undone, and worse, the jumble was leaning toward them precariously. Groaning, it sagged a little more toward them and stopped. Everything about it said the first board pulled free would bring the whole mass down on their heads. Arala began to cry softly. Tantalizing gaps admitted sunlight and allowed them to see the street, the sky, but nothing anyone could wriggle through, even Lucille. Fael could see the red scarf Galena had used to mark the building. It fluttered for a moment in the breeze. Staring at the scarf, she seized Megden's shoulder. I want you to try to make that scarf do something the wind wouldn't make it do. You want to attract attention? Aleandra said hoarsely. It's far more likely to be Shido than anyone else. Better that than dying down here of thirst, Fael replied, her voice harsher than she wanted. She would never see Perrin again, then. If Savannah had her chained, she would at least be alive for him to rescue. He would rescue her, she knew it. Her duty now was to keep the women who followed her alive, and if that meant captivity, so be it. Megden? I might spend all day trying to embrace the source and never succeed, the sun-haired woman said in dull tones. She stood slumped, staring at nothing. Her face suggested that she saw an abyss beneath her feet. And if I do embrace it, I can almost never weave anything. Fael loosened her grip on Megden and smoothed her hair instead. I know it's difficult, she said soothingly. Well, in truth, I don't know. I've never done it. But you have, and you can do it again. Our lives depend on you, Megden. I know the strength that's in you. I've seen it time and again. There is no surrender in you. I know you can do it, and so do you. Slowly, Megden's back straightened, and despair slid off her face. She might still see the abyss, but if she fell, she would fall without flinching. I'll try, she said. For a long while, she stared up at the scarf, then shook her head dejectedly. The source is there, like the sun just beyond the edge of sight, she whispered. But every time I try to embrace it, it's like trying to catch smoke with my fingers. Fael hastily pulled the Gaishine robes from her basket and another, careless of the gold belts and collars falling to the stone floor. Sit down, she said, arranging the robes in a pile. Make yourself comfortable. I know you can do it, Megden. Pressing the other woman down, she folded her legs and sat beside her. You can do it, Aleandra said softly, sitting down on Megden's other side. Yes, you can, Lucille whispered, joining them. I know you can, Arala said, as she lowered herself to the floor. Time passed, with Megden staring at the scarf. Fael whispered encouragement and held on to hope hard. Suddenly the scarf went rigid, as if something had pulled it taut. A wondrous smile appeared on Megden's face as the scarf began to swing back and forth like a pendulum. 6, 7, 8 times it swung. Then it fluttered in the breeze and fell limp. That was marvelous, Fael said. Marvelous, Aleandra said. You're going to save us, Megden. Yes, Arala murmured. You're going to save us, Megden. There were many kinds of battle. Sitting on the floor, whispering encouragement, Megden fighting to find what she could seldom find, they fought for their lives while the scarf swung, then fell to the breeze, swung and fell limp. But they fought on. Galena kept her head down and tried not to hurry as she made her way out of Malden, past the streams of white-clad men and women carrying empty buckets into the town and full buckets back out. She did not want to attract attention, not without that cursed belt and necklace. She had donned the things when she dressed in the night while Therava was still asleep, but it had been such a pleasure to remove them and hide them with the clothes and other things she had secreted away for her escape that she could not resist. Besides, Therava would have been angered to wake and find her missing. She would have ordered a watch for her little Lena, and everyone marked her by those jewels. Well, they would pay to help her return to the tower now. Return to her rightful place. That arrogant Fael and the other fools were dead or as good as, and she was free. She stroked the rod, hidden in her sleeve, and shivered with delight. Free! She did hate leaving Therava alive, but if anyone had entered the woman's tent and found her with a knife through her heart, Galena would have been the first suspect. Besides, images rose in her head of her bending stealthily over the sleeping Therava, the woman's own belt knife in hand, of Therava's eyes snapping open, meeting hers in the darkness, of her screaming, of her hand opening nervelessly to drop the knife, of her begging, of Therava... No, no! It would not have been that way, certainly not. She had left Therava alive of necessity, not because she was... not for any other reason. Suddenly wolves howled. Wolves in every direction, a dozen or more. Her feet stopped of their own accord. A motley collection of tents surrounded her. Walled tents, peaked tents, low Aiel tents. She had walked right through the Gai Shine portion of the camp without realizing it. Her eyes rose to the ridge west of Malden, and she flinched. Thick fog curled along the whole length of it, concealing the trees as far as she could see in either direction. The town walls hid the ridge to the east, yet she was sure there would be thick fog there, too. The man had come. The great lord preserve her, she had been just in time. Well, he would not find his fool wife, even if he managed to survive whatever he was about to try. Nor would he find Galina Kasban. Thanking the great lord that Tharava had not forbidden her to ride, the woman had much preferred dangling the possibility that she might be allowed if she groveled sufficiently. Galina hurried toward her hidden stores. Let the fools who wanted to die here die. She was free. Free!